You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Ward County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400. Or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
Good morning. This is not Lisa Seif. This is Marvelline Prince and Kelly Scroggins, who's going to co-host with me today. We have an exciting show, and we've got two special guests from who has been associated with the Healing Place. If you need to call in, you need to call 424-1400. We're going to have some healthy discussion. We started our day out at 9 o'clock with out at the Golden Corral, about 15, 20 people there to greet our guests, to talk more about addictions, where do we want to go, what do we want to do, and I'm going to shut up and start with Kelly asking some questions of our guests. The other number you can call if you're not from the area is 888-846-7867. Before we start to ask our guest questions, I need to introduce Leslie Jackson, who is with the Coalition, and our co-sponsors, Ms. Emily Winters Brown, who's going to talk about what we're doing together, Kelly, who is with the task force, and we have a young man here that came with our guest by the name of Chris. So we're going to get started.
Thanks, Marvelline. At this time, Emily, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself and the agency that you work for and the work that you're doing here in Vandenberg County?
Thank you, Kelly. Good morning to those listeners. I would like to say, first of all, that I want to recognize our executive director of CAPE, Ms. Alice Weathers, and the CAPE Minority Health Initiative, where I serve in the position of the Minority Health Coordinator. And the mission of the CAPE Minority Health Initiative is to eliminate health disparities by way of advocacy, education and awareness, and providing access to health care services for minority populations, and empower the citizens of Vandenberg County to improve their quality of life. And a few months ago, Ms. Prince asked that we join her in this effort to make a change with reference to the problem that we are having in the Vandenberg County area, specifically minority-populated areas, and that is with the drugs. She works very closely with the drug courts, and we see the problem as our young men and women, I might say as well, who are do not trust the law, the judicial system here. And so we are trying to make ways in which we can work together to bring some of those things to a close. The Minority Health Initiative is responsible for providing services that some of these drug abusers may need, and we can provide those services by having some of the local agencies to come in and maybe give talks to them, provide those drug treatments that they would need, and to help pave the way for them to become a part of the to mainstream them back into society to make a positive contribution.
Thank you, Emily. Also, we have Ms. Leslie Jackson here with us today. Leslie, if you wouldn't mind, would you share a little bit with us about your position and how you have seen substance abuse and the role that you played at the Sheriff's Department?
Good morning. My name is Leslie Jackson. I'm a case manager with the Vandenberg County Sheriff's Department, and I thank you all for having me here today, Marvelline, everybody. I'm a case manager. I've been a case manager for with the department for about 14 years, but in many different capacities over there. I actually manage the participants' caseloads that have been sentenced to the correction complex. We have gotten away from being called the safe house, so now we're called community corrections. We're trying to correct the problem. I deal with participants, we call them participants. I deal with the participants that have been charged with drugs, crimes, theft, burglary, all kind of different crimes that's been, we bring them to the safe house so that they don't have to go to prison. That's a step away from prison. So I try to help them be productive back into the community by offering any kind of anger management classes, any kind of drug rehabilitation classes, anything that's going to help them be productive back into society. We help them get a job. That is a work release facility, so you have to have a job being there because they charge fees.
What do you think the percentage of those accomplishments of the people that come through that program? What's the statistics in terms of who doesn't return to the system, approximately?
Personally, if I have to base it out off of 100%, those that return, maybe 50, over half.
Okay.
Return.
Why do you think we're seeing such a high recidivism rate?
I think because they get back out there and they do the same thing. Okay. Now, when they're in the facility, a lot of them do great. A lot of people need structure, education, to know how to do the right thing so that when they're released, they don't go back to the same issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's exactly one of the points that we wanted to make today. One of our focuses today is going to be the need for long-term treatment here in the Vandenberg County area. Treatment in the form of a formalized treatment program, transitional housing, recovery houses, some additional long-term follow-up, aftercare, continuing care, whatever terminology we want to use. We recognize that after completing a program that they do need some follow-up care to address some of those same issues that you talked about. And that's why we brought our guest in today from Louisville, Kentucky. We have with us today Mr. Keith Fishback, who is a Healing Place alumni, and Ms. Reagan Underwood, who also was a participant in the Healing Place program, who is working diligently in Louisville, working with women in recovery. Keith, if you would you just share with us a little bit about your experiences at the Healing Place? Your experience in recovery, long-term treatment, anything that you have to offer?
Yeah, this is Keith, and one of the things I want to, first of all, thank you guys for having us here. And they was talking about this structure, and one of the main things that was really a tool for me to use was accountability to myself. After learning how to do some things back into the normal society.
Mm-hmm,
When I was so used to doing everything that I want, that's what brought us to this point, led me to the Healing Place.
That's right.
And it was just great to see people, physically see people doing these things in their life. Like I was at our earlier meeting, we was talking about how we follow things.
Mm-hmm.
And if I see somebody who is doing things correct, I have no problem just adjusting. And I got a better feel for myself,
you know,
had more self-worth.
Okay.
And it just helped me make good decisions, man. And I keep a network of people around me that helps me daily at the time, you know. And those have been some of the great things that learning in a structured treatment facility to help me better my life. And we just try to pass it on to others.
Tell me about the Healing Place and what it did for you. What you did for it.
The Healing Place was just fine without me. That was one of the great perceptions that I had in my mind that, you know, the Healing Place was going to conform to me. But in a matter of minutes, they showed me.
They showed you who was the boss, right?
Yeah. This is a great organization. And we don't advocate for the Healing Place or any of that. I don't stand in for the Healing
right.
Place. I was led there from a higher power. Mm-hmm. And the individuals there had enough genuine concern to love me back to life.
That's right.
And let me start being responsible enough to not be so much worried about me and just to learn how to help others. And it's like that movie I watched, Paid in Full. You know, you continue to help people and help people help other people, and it's a snowball effect. And, it's just a great tool.
What about you, Reagan? What would you say have been some valuable experiences that you got either from the healing place or just along your path of recovery?
Well, one of the things...
Speaking in my...
One of the things that the healing place did for me is it gave me a foundation, some discipline, like waking up at a certain time of the day and starting my day. Doing drugs and alcohol, I lost all conception of that.
That's right.
I get up when I felt like it. I lay down when I pass out. I didn't ever lay down. I just fall out.
That's right.
Because I stayed up so long. So one of the things it did for me is show me how to get up and be a responsible citizen. And as a result of that, I was able to go and work a job like a normal person. I didn't have any employable skills or anything. They just gave me this structure that I needed because, like I told you all earlier, I was just living like a savage.
Sure.
You know, that became my normal life, and the healing place helped me to get back in society. You know, I'm not existing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was just existing when I was drinking. And the healing place allowed me to get on my own 2 feet, be responsible, like Keith said, for myself, and be okay with helping somebody else and not want anything in return.
Right.
Because like I shared earlier, I never repay them for what they gave me. If they asked for a penny, I couldn't afford it to get in there. So they just open the doors and say, okay, this is what we have to offer you. You can take it or you can leave it. I took it.
How tough was it for you?
In the beginning, it was tough because I didn't like looking at me. See, once the alcohol and the drugs was gone, I was left with me and my behavior, and I just didn't believe my behavior kept me sick as I was. And they allowed me. They said, okay, you gonna steal? Okay, this is what you need to do. This is your consequence. You know, they showed me that for every action, there's a consequence.
Yeah.
So it was pretty tough because, like he said, we were used to doing what we wanted to do, how we wanted to do it. And if I got caught, it was your fault. It wasn't Matt. And they showed me how to take a look at me. You know, if I make a bad choice, then I get a bad consequence. If I make a good choice, I get a good consequence.
Reagan.
I'm sorry.
I think one thing that I liked about the healing place, Reagan, was that whole process of accountability.
Right.
Learning to be accountable for my actions to other people as well. Because like you said, when we were using, that was something that I know I wasn't used to. And I think that was one of the benefits of being in a program that long. Not only did you get a chance to address the addiction, but you stayed in there long enough so all those behaviors surfaced sooner or later.
Yes.
You could only mask for so long. If you stayed in the program long enough around other recovering people, all of your issues was going to surface. And for people like myself who would try to mask or hide those, you know, I was in the right place because sooner or later something showed up and they knew exactly what area you needed to get some help on.
Yeah, because I can't see me.
Yeah.
Do we
have... Reagan, I would just like to pause and ask you, since we are about the Head Start program, CAPE is one of the largest here. I want to know from you what kind of impact it has on children. You spoke earlier about your children. And so what kind of impact it has on children?
The impact of getting sober?
Getting sober, but prior to that. What kind of impact, how has it affected children and what can be done to rectify
Like I shared earlier with you guys, it depends on how devastating, you know, the child was during the parent's addiction. You know, some kids can fall right in place and some kids may have been so scarred where they need counseling. They have Alateen. For kids, it just depends on that child's situation. Like I said, our kids, they're aware of recovery. They encourage it for us. And if we don't go and we don't do something, they ask us. So, I mean, it just depends on that individual, what the parent think their child needs. You know, we don't try to force it on them. But 9 times out of 10, as you get better, your family gets better. And if you see some things... I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Do we have a caller?
Yes.
Okay. Caller?
Yes, hello. Thank you, Marvelline and Kelly and Alice, for hosting the show. And thank you for our guests from coming all the way from Louisville to carry their message and experience strength and hope. That's awesome, and you guys are excited about recovery and sobriety. It's exciting to hear. I have one question for the guests.
Go ahead.
You all talk about how we can carry this message to those that are still suffering. Could you advise us on how we can carry this message to the community? Politically, economically, socially, how can we get to the bigger picture outside the rooms of recovery and let people know that we're there and that we need help for this health-related illness? Again, thanks for coming. Marvelline, you're awesome, and you're right. This is a cancer in our community. Thanks again.
Who wants to answer? We've got about a couple of minutes. We have to take a break.
Well, are you doing it now?
Exactly.
you're doing it now. Mm-hmm. This radio show is outside of, you know, meetings, and you'd be surprised who's listening. So this is one great way to start.
Yeah, and another way I would always reiterate just the consistency of mm-hmm. having the information available mm-hmm. Would be a very useful tool for someone, because I tend to forget real quickly. But if I'm always able to hear it and rehear it and mm-hmm. rehear it, I tend to grab hold a little easier.
Mm-hmm. I think probably 10, 15 years ago, we wouldn't have even been having this conversation because we didn't have, we maybe didn't have the conversation, but it wasn't getting out to the audience or the community because we didn't have the pump. We didn't have the black-owned newspaper. So I think that the pump has really helped us to get some of the word out. In fact, when we did the show a couple of 3 weeks ago, the phones never stopped ringing mm-hmm. because people are wanting to have some dialogue about this, and they're real supportive.
But is this coming from people like you guys that is willing to help someone else? Because we're all screaming for help, but due to fear and shyness and stupidity some, well, I wouldn't say stupidity, ignorance, just not knowing, you know, because none of us are dumb. We just make some bad choices. But with people just giving this information, if I could just break through that fear, I'm able to grab a hold of this solution that they have for us to make a new way of living.
The churches, and I know that we probably don't want to go too far there, but I have to bring it up. What can we do to get the churches involved? There are some churches that have allowed organizations to have, you know, AA meetings, NA meetings. That's great. But I'm talking about actively involved and talking about the drug cancer, AIDS, emotional diseases. We talk about physical impairments. And pray for that person. But what do you see in Louisville? Is that sort of the same norm, or is things a little bit different?
A little bit different. For instance, one church, and I won't put anybody on the spot. The first Friday, or I think the second Friday of every month, they have a meeting, and it's not so much as. AA based. It's what's the name of their meeting? Anyway, huh?
Al-Anon.
No. It's for the people, by the people from church, and they hold it. You know, you can come and talk about anything. You can talk about your addiction. You can talk about living situations. Okay. Just whatever it is. You know, they don't exclude anybody. And that's one thing, like I was telling you guys earlier, I was just blessed to have a pastor that just understands what we are going through. You know, I think it's a choice of the ministers and pastors mm-hmm. to get involved mm-hmm. with recovery, you know, and then there is that fine line of religiousness and this and that. So, you know, I believe it's just the individual churches that chooses to step up and say, okay, this is the problem. we want to help.
And, you know, just to kind of piggyback off that, too, I think we are seeing an increasing number of churches and ministries being developed in churches specifically for people who have addictions because of the need. You know, there's a greater number of people with addictions in churches. You know, addiction is beginning to hit almost every family, every racial line. And so the more public awareness we see, the more we see that, you know. So I do know that some churches are kind of slow, but I think a lot of churches really are being a little bit more receptive. I think another thing it takes is commitment on the part of us, on those of us that are in recovery, because a lot of times what happens is God blesses us to get clean and sober. We go to church and we sit there and act like we never did drugs. So it really requires some transparency. It really requires some transparency on our part, because as an alcoholic and receiving the free gift of sobriety, it really is my responsibility to help the next alcoholic or addict. And I can't help you if I'm so worried about my image or your perception of me that I'm unwilling to share with you that I am in recovery. And so I think the more of us inside of the church start to be honest about where we've been, the more help we can be.
And that's a key thing you talk about, being honest, because we equate churches as a vessel to help us, but I have to have the courage to let them know that I need help. So, and again, brings willingness. So, and I think all the, but we're dealing with human people. Mm-hmm. You know, they make a lot of mistakes. Mm-hmm. I don't think any pastor or anybody that's trying to be related with a church would turn down and not help anyone.
And if I may, the churches is where we rooted from.
Exactly.
So this is where we should be able to get the strength to be able to speak on things like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, just like when drug addiction began to hit our communities, none of us knew what to do. You know, because we got to be honest, especially with crack. When crack came into our community, it came in quick, right. and it just took out a whole bunch of people all at once. We didn't realize that there was, at that time, we didn't really realize that there was really a difference in a cocaine addiction and a crack addiction. You know, we didn't realize the effects that crack was going to have, not only on me, but my children, my brothers, my co-workers, my next door neighbors. We didn't realize that. And so I think the churches now are really just beginning to see the magnitude of the problem, you know. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, I think their lack of help doesn't necessarily come out of a lack of willingness, but sometimes just out of not knowing what to do.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, not knowing what to do.
I think it's a little strange, though, that the crack cocaine ended up in the black community. The cocaine.
There you go.
I don't know.
It's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy, Marmalee.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we can laugh about this, but the sadness and the real truth is it brings it back to the individual to be able to realize that they have a problem and
I know
ask
that.
For some help.
But when you are living in poverty, and all you see, I saw a man, you know, I watch the prison show sometimes, the big ones where it's gangs and it's, I mean, you don't want to be in that prison. He said all he ever seen when he was growing up was drug dealers. He never seen anybody come out of the house with a fire department uniform on. He never seen a black officer in his neighborhood. So all he thought was what he'd seen
so
every day.
So that becomes his role model. So
right.
Association is simulation. So if I see everybody hanging on the corner, that's what's going to inspire me to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it starts at home, to be able to educate the children, to show them how to establish credit, show them how to get jobs, show them how to do things that normal people are doing.
But what if the parents are users?
Everybody won't be a user.
I know that, but I'm saying we know that we would do that with our children, you know.
Well, the parents are using. You find situations where the parents are using, the grandparents are using,
right?
But that's where the community gets involved.
Exactly,
also,
Keith.
Someone in the community is actually concerned. But it seems like we lost a generation where it's so disrespectful. It's fearful of trying to talk to another person's child, you know?
Okay. Oh, so, yeah. So it's different now.
It's a touchy situation.
It's different.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
When you live
we have a call. I think we have a caller. Good morning, caller.
Good Good morning. I want to ask the question, and any of you can answer it. What do you think is the main reason why the dealers feel safe in our neighborhood? Is it because of the loyalty of the folks in the neighborhood not to report them or to take any kind of action, even, you know, like the preachers or our community action people that we have? Or do you think it is because people actually fear the drug dealers and whatnot, and they don't want to get involved?
Thanks for your call, caller. Who wants to answer that?
I think there are several reasons. A lot of the reasons is because the drug dealers are our children. You know, very few strangers are coming from across town, coming into my neighborhood, taking up shop.
They're not the real drug dealers.
Okay.
We know that, don't we? Don't we?
Well, yeah. I think he was speaking of the street level drug dealers, the ones that we see standing on the street corner,
exactly.
The ones who have the dope houses in the
but
neighborhood.
We are the reason for the children doing what they do.
Well, a lot of things come into play with that. Also, supply and demand.
That's right.
So it goes back to the family's education, educating the children. See, because I couldn't sell you anything if you wasn't willing to buy it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Did it answer your question, caller? Because we got to take a break. Okay, thank you. We'll be back in a few.
Technician from SafeLight Auto Glass.
Torn up roads can cause big problems for windshields. My last customer ignored a small chip on his, drove over a pothole, and crack. If only he called us sooner. When a chip's small, we can usually repair it in just a half hour with our state-of-the-art resin. A SafeLight repair is so reliable, we guarantee it for life. And with most insurance plans, there's no cost to you.
Call SafeLight at 1-800-800-2727.
SafeLight Repair, SafeLight Replace.
Hear that? That's the sound of staying well. Because when I, on Walgreens.com, I can refill my family's prescriptions automatically with a, I can check prescription histories and set reminders for when they're ready to pick up. All it takes is a, to set up free shipping or arrange pickup even when I'm out of town. So, on Walgreens.com today and register. It's as easy as, ing your heels together. Walgreens.com, where your daily life and better health, just click. Walgreens, there's a way to stay well.
Hey, you. Yeah, you listening to the radio. It's me again. Have you got that HIV test yet? As I mentioned before, if you have put yourself at risk by having unprotected sex with more than one person or used IV drugs, guess what? You've put yourself at risk for HIV. Make that appointment today by calling the Vandenberg County Health Department at 435-5683 or stop by 420 East Mulberry. It's that easy. Remember, everything is confidential. No one has to know you've gotten the test unless you tell them, so do it. What do you have to lose except maybe your life or your partner's life? When in doubt, get checked out.
My car needs a sip of some smooth, clean, and refreshing high-quality motor oil, and I'm going to take it to Award-Winning Oil Change. At Award-Winning Oil Change, they take care of all my car's needs. For $20 on most vehicles, the mechanic will change the oil and inspect the car for safety and drivability issues for free. Isn't that awesome? I go there because they are very professional, and they have good service for good people at a great price. It's truly a one-stop shop. They're not the average oil change. They have a team of professional mechanics that take care of my suspension work, brakes, shocks, struts, and tune-ups. And why do I go to Award-Winning Oil Change located across from Deaconess Hospital at the corner of Harriet and Virginia? Pricing. They are the home of the $20 oil change, and that includes a free vehicle inspection. So stop clowning around and follow me to the best place in town, Award-Winning Oil Change, at the corner of Harrod and Virginia, or call them at 424-1992.
You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Ward County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400, or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
Good morning, Marvelline Prince and Kelly Scroggins. Fill it in for Lisa today. If you have a call, 424-1400. We are live, 888-846-7867. And our guest today is Keith and Reagan. We had breakfast this morning with them from 9 to 10:30. Fantastic. Had a lot of discussion. A lot of our task force members were there. So it's going. It's going. It's going to take a while, but we're not in a rush. I'm going to turn it back over to Kelly, who's my co-host this morning.
Thanks, Marvelline. What we'd like to talk about a little bit now is how our substance abuse or our addiction affected us once we got sober, the challenges or the difficulties one would face in finding employment. Reagan, could either you or Keith speak to that, some of the challenges that maybe you faced or you've seen others face and what they had to do to overcome those problems?
Well, one of the things I got, you got to remember that me getting the job was started way before my alcohol. Once I got into alcohol, I had so many felonies that, you know, if an employer wanted to hire someone, I was overlooked because of my lack of showing up at work. I caused the reasons for me not to be able to be employed. Mm-hmm. But after getting with some guys that are trying to do something different in life, as I learned how to get into the spirituality of this process, that the Creator was going to open doors for me whether I had felonies or not. Now, I got to choose to continue to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And it just progressively getting better from there. And if I get employed, I need to show up for work. I caused me to lose my job and not be able to get hired.
Okay. What about you, Reagan?
What I found out, Kelly, is to piggyback off of what he was saying, when I got sober, I didn't have any employable skills. But what I did was trust my higher power. Mm-hmm. And I just stepped out on faith and I started putting in applications and I was a little bit honest about, you know, I didn't do a whole history, but I let them know where I had been and where I come from. Okay. And this is what I was willing to do for them today if they gave me a shot. Right. Some people closed the doors, and the ones that were supposed to be open opened up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just show up and do what I'm supposed to do on a day-to-day mm-hmm. basis. Am I perfect? No. But if I continue to be sincere in my walk, then I don't worry about anything mm-hmm. else.
Okay. You know, I was just thinking about my experience, you know. I could always get a job. I just couldn't keep a job, you know. And I was one of the people that was blessed throughout my addiction not to have a criminal history, but I had a horrible work history because I, too, showed up late, called in sick when I wasn't sick, left early on payday and didn't come back, and, you know, did all those types of things. So what I had to do, because I faced all those challenges, because my resume was 2 months here, 30 days here, 2 weeks here, that kind of thing. So what I had to do was practice a lot of humility. When I got sober, I had to be willing to take whatever job became available to me, even if it wasn't in my field and didn't pay the kind of money that I wanted to make. Mm-hmm. I had to be willing to work whatever job came available to me and then work that job diligently, show up on time, do the job that they asked me to do. And just like I was rebuilding my life, I was rebuilding my work history as well. And sometimes as alcoholics and addicts, we're not willing to do that. We think, okay, I got sober, and when I You know, in my addiction, I was making $40,000-$50,000 a year. Now I'm clean and sober. Give me my job back. And it just doesn't work like that, you know. Or if you aspire to be somebody making however many dollars just because you get sober, you don't all automatically start there. So we had to be willing to start anywhere and do any kind of job, you know, utilize services and programs. Work. There are people in the community and agencies that work with people that have felonies. There are jobs and companies that will hire people with felonies. Exactly. You just have to be willing to do the legwork. You know, you can't be so willing to give up so easily, mm-hmm. you know. And so that would be my advice to those people who've had those kinds of challenges. You know, you got to be diligent in it.
I think Judge Trotman is working on something as it relates to people getting out of prison, is what I call it, and finding employment, setting up some kind of maybe agreement with agencies or something of the sort. I'm not real clear on that, but I know he's working on, I think he's working on something on that.
Okay. I know earlier we had talked about a lack of trust, because one of the problems that we're seeing here in Evansville, especially with our drug court, is there seems to be a lack of trust among the African-American community, be it the judicial, the correctional system, whereas our people just aren't willing to work with programs, drug court, stepping stones. They're not completing the program successfully. Does anybody, Leslie, got any experience on that or any reasons or anybody?
Well, my experience with it, when they're in the program, they do pretty good. I mean, because they're there because they need a structured environment.
When you say in the program, you mean in the corrections facility? Okay.
In the corrections facility.
Okay.
Or in Davenport and Drug Court is a facility where they don't have to stay there. They report every day on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's still structured. It's when they get out of that structured environment, what do we have to offer them then?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I know from personal experience, my son is going to be graduating from drug court on Tuesday. It was hard.
Mm-hmm.
Reporting. If you don't report, you got to do community service hours. You know, Leslie, you know all that. I mean, it takes, you have to change your whole mindset,
mm-hmm.
and say, I'm going to do this, because it's hard. Drug court is very, I mean, it's the long and narrow. If you just deviate just a little bit, you're out. So, yeah, it's a very tough program, but it's intended to do that.
It is.
It's intended to do that.
Yeah, because we all know alcoholics, we're undisciplined. We're undisciplined. Anything that sounds like structure, discipline, good orderly direction, we don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why I think, again, we talked about the Hilton Place. I think programs like that are necessary. Because, Reagan, you mentioned earlier about having to get up. And when I lived at the Hilton Place, we had to get up every single morning
mm-hmm.
by a certain time, get dressed, come downstairs, and say to the kitchen staff, the people who are in the kitchen preparing our breakfast, good morning, kitchen. I would be so mad. But it taught me that there's a certain time of day that I got to get up. You know, that sounds, and to other people it sounds crazy. But for real, like Reagan said, I was used to getting up when I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so those are some of the things that we need to relearn, which is why we talked about the need for long-term programming.
How do we get a healing place of sorts in Evansville, Indiana? Because we don't have anything. Once people leave Stepping Stone, how many days is that?
It's a 14-day program at Stepping Stone.
14 days, you're going to be all right.
And then they go into what they call IOP, which is intensive outpatient, where they come in maybe once to twice a week, once for a group meeting, once every 2 weeks to probably meet with their case manager or social worker. There may be some random drops in between, mm-hmm. but, mm-hmm. you know, that's what their program looks like.
Well, I think the intent is, you know, they set up the women's healing place.
The Warm Center? Oh, the one in Louisville?
Yeah, a new decade, a new home for women and children. It is fantastic. I've got the brochure, the booklet. But I'd like to see us at least start that process of something similar. I mean, we don't have to try to be as big as the Healing Place, because it took years for them to get where they are. But 12 days and then you're sort of on your own, right?
Well, this is a process that you can't do alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to take time. As far as how do you start a healing place, I wouldn't know because I never started a healing place. I just ended up at the healing place. What I do know is that the healing place is generally concerned for individuals. And if you was to contact the healing place, I do know that they do replicas.
Now, they sure do.
How do you qualify for it, or why do they store it in your community? I wouldn't be able to answer those questions.
We need to check into that.
You would have to check with the healing place.
Of course.
And I know one thing that Reagan and I was talking about earlier, you know, a lot of times we get concerned with numbers, for instance. Now, a healing place, I think when I was there in the women's house that I was in, there was like 80 of us or something. And I think like in the men's house, it can be up to 100 and something, whatever. So that's kind of a big facility. And so we may not, because our city isn't as large as Louisville, so we may not be able to do something as big as the healing place and help as many people starting off. But I do think that we need to start the process to start helping somebody on a long-term basis, offering something at least similar to not only the healing place, but other proven programs, you know.
Okay. We talked about, you know, crack, cocaine, and the meth community is so huge now. That's really unfortunate. But for some reason, black folks are not using meth.
No, you're right.
They're not using it.
Not in large numbers.
Well, I haven't seen any, and I work out to Vandenberg County Corrections.
Oh, well, I know people personally. But yeah.
In terms of alcohol, we've had family members, extended family mm-hmm. members, that's long-term use of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
How has that impacted on families, the alcohol thing? When you got children, a wife, or... You know what I'm saying, Reagan, Keith?
Well, the impact that alcohol...
Especially if you got children, small children.
The impact that alcohol had on my family. One of the impacts was with my mother. She stayed up worried about me all day, all night, wondering mm-hmm. if she was going to see me on the news or somebody going to call her and tell her I was dead. You know, the other impact that it had is I gave my children away. I thought I was doing what was best for them. Actually, I was giving them out the way so I could do what I thought I needed to do. You know, my thinking told me that this is what's best for them. And as a result, I haven't seen my daughters in years. You know, but that's okay because I know it's in his time, I'm at. So, you know, another impact was me, you know, bypassing my son's school early in the morning, trying not to see him. You know, he's looking for me, or he gets to the point where he says, okay, I know she ain't coming back. Bye. You know, that's the kind of impact that me drinking had on my family. Now that I don't drink, he knows I'm coming back. My mom don't have to worry about seeing me on the news. You know, I can be a responsible parent, and so forth and so on.
Is he or any of your children having some emotional difficulties as a result of, and I'm sure, that's a dumb question, right?
Well, it definitely affects the children emotionally.
Especially younger children.
Yeah. I actually lost custody of my kids due to me drinking. And thank God that I ended up at the healing place. And by me going through the healing place, it allowed me the patience and the understanding that I had to do this, this, and this. To get custody, and now I have custody of my kids. It's still one child that I don't have custody of yet, but I'm still working on it. So it affects it not only the children, everybody who we come in contact with will affect. But we learn how to make positive adjustments in life now.
It's a disease, right?
It's absolutely a disease.
It's an illness.
Yes.
So people don't say, when I grow up, I want to drink and just be an alcoholic, right?
And the medical community is now even willing to admit that, yes, it is a disease.
Does it think some of it's genetic? Do you?
I mean, it could be. It's
the addictions.
That's one theory, and it's a personal belief.
Okay.
You know, when we were talking about the impact of alcohol on families, I wanted to talk about it from another perspective, with alcohol being a gateway drug. because I was just thinking about my usage. I know me and several people that I know in recovery, we all started with alcohol. You know, we started with alcohol, and I think that's one of the things that's kind of overlooked in our community because it's legal. We can buy it in every street corner. Everybody we know drinks, you know, so as young children, we grow up thinking there's nothing wrong with drinking because it's not illegal. But what it actually, it was the drug that I started on that opened me up to be adventurous and try other drugs, you know, and I think that was, that's one of the concerns that I have with alcohol is alcohol, because many of us, our kids, they start off sipping out the wine bottle, the beer bottle that's left from mama's parties last night. And how many of us have family members that are alcoholics? We know they're alcoholics. Everybody has an Uncle Bud or somebody who gets drunk and falls out. And we just kind of accept that person for being who he is, you know? And unless his alcoholism is directly ruining something for us, we just kind of accept that person's been alcoholic. We overlook alcoholism. It seems like we don't really, we're not as concerned about alcohol use as we are about drug use.
I remember I had one case years ago when I was at Legal Services, and this young man was an alcoholic. He was only like 20-something. He said he had been drinking since he was 5 years old because what happened, his parents, they partied, and they wanted him to go to sleep, so they would give him alcohol so he could sleep. And after a while, his body couldn't do without it. So it was a sad situation. I remember that case, very sad.
And then he crossed that invisible line that when we take a drink, we can't metabolize it properly. And then we go on to do other things.
Keith, if you would, we talked about alcohol being a disease or illness. Can you speak to the disease factor, the craving, the obsession, what happens to us as alcoholics when it comes to that?
Yeah. One of the things I can relate to it because I do everything I think. If I think about something long enough, that's what I'm going to do. And that's what they're talking about, that mental obsession. Well, and the disease factor is a mental obsession. Now, it's coupled with this allergy that I have that makes it a disease. So you have to learn what is an allergy, what is obsession. And we're taught those things. This obsession is the thought that overrides every other thought. So when I take a drink, because I can't metabolize it, it says the phenomenon of craving develops, and it's an unexplainable occurrence. So I was so bright that I always knew this. I didn't have to figure it out. If y'all don't know what it is, I can't be smarter than you. I ended up in a homeless shelter.
We're not laughing like it's funny, but it's real simple
because of this mental obsession, and I have this physical allergy. When I take a drink, my body does some things, the phenomenon of craving develops, and I go on this spree. Now I'm sad, I feel guilty, I'm destroying everybody in my path, and those are just the, and that's what happens with this disease, and that's what goes on. So that's how I'm able to identify with this obsession, because I just tear things up.
Wow. I want to ask a question of either one of you. When I taught wellness, I'm sorry, when I taught the course wellness, I had students, and they ranged from ages 16 on up to 24, 25 years of age. And when they would tell the story that it was so bad between them and their parents, like one of the young men would tell me that he would supply his mother with drugs when she needed a fix, and they would do it together. So what do you, that to me is a pretty sad situation. How can you help either or? What is the answer or the solution to correcting that, or is there?
Well, there's always a solution, I believe. Getting to it is a problem. Because you got to remember that the reason I'm selling these drugs is for me to have some money. I'm not concerned about what it's doing to anybody. And we look at that as just self-centeredness. I'm just looking out for me. I don't mean no harm. I don't know it's destroying you. And just not being able to see the truth. Now the solution is to get on with the facts that, hey, this is causing a problem. But then that would affect my pocketbook.
But then when you hear a student say, I had to sell drugs to help my mother pay the rent.
Well, a student could say, I had to get a job to help my mother pay the rent.
But that's
choice.
But we want the easier way, you know, and because this is what I see everybody in my neighborhood do. So I'm going to do what they do. But if I seen anybody going to work, maybe I would have been influenced to go to work.
And, you know, I just wanted to add, you know, we talk about cultural diversity and cultural awareness. You know, and there are different racial cultures, but there is also a thing called the culture of addiction.
Yes.
There is a whole set of rules that we play by in the world of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one of the ways that we are able to help those that are drug addicted and those that are affected by addiction is learning the culture. You know, what you're speaking of is just the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sounds kind of harsh, but that's what it is. You know, a child grows up watching mom week after week, month after month, spending her whole paycheck, spending the food stamps, and the child is watching the dope man come to the house and get the money, or watching mom leave out the house with the money, and when all the money is gone, that child and her siblings are now hungry. And it's something about survival of the fittest kicks in and says, you know what? I'm sick and tired of that dope man getting all of our money and me and my brothers and sisters being hungry. And because we got to eat, if she going to spend all the money on dope, I might as well get the money so that way I can make sure that me and my siblings have something to eat. That sounds kind of crazy to normal people who don't use, but for a child who's trying to make sure that he and his siblings can eat, that's the only thing they know to do. You can't go get a job. They ain't going to give you the food stamps. Mama ain't going to give you her check. If you tell the social worker school, all they're going to do is take you out from your mama and put you on CPS. So unfortunately, that child is doing the only thing that he or she knows how to do to ensure that he and his sisters or brothers have something to eat. You know, kids do stuff like that to pay the rent. You know, and that's why we need to, in order for us to be able to help these people, we have to really understand the whole culture of what goes on in drug addiction. I mean, I remember one time when I was on drugs, I shared with a family member, I said, I'm only hurting myself. You know, and when we're on drugs, we think that. We think we're only hurting ourselves. But like Keith had mentioned earlier, we hurt not only ourselves, we hurt everybody around us. Our kids are really affected by what we do, you know. And that's why you have things like that going on.
Call in 424-1400. What else?
Anybody else want to speak to the culture of addiction? Because there's a whole lot of behaviors associated with the getting high, staying high, our kids learning how to survive. You know, that's what we talked about earlier about kids acting out of school. I think somebody gave that scenario.
And then it seems normal. And if I don't know the difference, that's what they call the delusion.
Yeah.
It seems like that's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been taught any better, so who's to say it's not the right thing to do? But a sober person knows difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so that brings it to the ignorance, just mm-hmm. not knowing.
Yeah.
One of the things that I heard when I first got in recovery is that I can't do better until I learn better.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then another thing that happens with the children and the, you know, the people that's selling drugs is they become just as addicted to the lifestyle as mm-hmm. I do the drug itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you know, and then the delusion, it grows and you're like, well, this is all I know and this is, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just not true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But because of the choice that I made, I'm in this lifestyle and I'm like, well, if I stop, then mm-hmm. I'm not going to make the money I used to
exactly.
make.
Exactly, yeah.
Or if I stop drinking, then I'm not going to be able to escape life like I used to. I mm-hmm. just got to deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned all these things by going to long-term treatment.
Long-term treatment.
Looking at me. Being willing to look at me because I wasn't willing. Mm-hmm. Until they say, well, 10,000, do it. You know, I did a lot of writing. But it was the best thing that could have happened
mm-hmm.
to me. Mm-hmm. It was the best thing, going to treatment and burial still. So I good luck with getting a place started, like we were talking earlier. Mm-hmm. Step out on faith.
So knowledge is power, right?
Knowledge
is power.
Knowledge
is exactly
power.
What I tell my participants. Knowledge is power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wonder if our city is ready for, I mean, it's so much involved in this. We do have to come and talk with the administrators or the CEOs or whoever the heck we got to talk to at the Healing Place. Emily, talk a little bit briefly, because time's running out, about what we want to do with, how we want to interact with the Minority Health Coalition.
Well, I think that we are able to provide, as I stated earlier, our mission is to eliminate health disparities, and I think one of the things
so
that
does
we,
that include addictions of a child, maybe? What do you mean when you say
bringing in a program that would address whatever the problem is that a child may be experiencing? And we are not at that point yet, but I think that can very easily be done now that we are intertwined with the drug task force. And so I see us as being able to do a lot of the things that you really want to get into.
We're running out of time, and I want to thank our guests, Reagan, Keith, Leslie, Emily. Kelly, are you here? Kelly and our guest that came with them are Chris, and this is Marveline. And
until next week,
we're here until next week. Lisa will be back, and we'll see you and talk with you then.